And our special guest, Ben Mezrich, we're talking about all his works now, the 37th Parallel, about the UFO Highway, and how about the other two successful books, Bringing Down the House, an incredible story about Las Vegas, and then, of course, the founding of Facebook, The Accidental Billionaires. We'll chat with him about those two stories as well, and your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Ben Mezrich with us. Ben, before we take calls, let's get into your other two incredible books that were turned into movies. They were just fantastic. The inside story of six MIT students who took down Vegas for millions. How did you get that information?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I basically met those guys at a bar. I was a fiction writer at the time, and there was this group of college kids who hung out in this local college bar in Boston. And they were, you know, geeky math science guys, but they had tons of money, and it was all in $100 bills. And the thing is, in Boston, you never see $100 bills. So I really couldn't figure out why they had all this money, and I just started hanging out with them. And they invited me to go to Vegas with them, and I went, and I kind of saw the MIT blackjack team in action. They had $1 million in cash on them. They had hidden it under their clothes, and
Jeez.
They landed in Vegas, and, you know, they would hit the casinos as a team spread out across the casino and using this card counting system. And so I convinced them to let me be a part of the team for a few months and so I could write the story.
And did their system, I assume it worked?
Oh, yeah. They won about $6 million. It was a pretty simple mathematical system where you keep track of the high cards and the low cards. But what was interesting about it was they would spread all these college kids out across the casino so they could be playing every table in the casino at the same time. And then the big money guy, the guy they would call the big player, would get signaled in to each table, so he would only be playing on the good decks. So you basically, he would make a $10,000 bet here, a $10,000 bet there, but every one of his bets had a positive outcome on it. So they won a lot of money. You know, they'd win a few hundred thousand dollars a night doing it. Eventually they got taken down. Nothing they were doing was illegal. You know, you can't get arrested for
it. You can't get arrested for conduct. You can get kicked out.
Kicked out, and they definitely got kicked out. Yeah. You know, a couple of them got beat up a couple times. Things like that happened. But it was wild to watch. And, you know, I've been kicked out of a handful of casinos myself now. it's an interesting experience.
And the movie 21 with Kevin
Spacey,
that's right.
Right.
Heading up the team, right?
Yeah, so basically I had written an article for Wired magazine along with the book, and I was sitting at home, and the phone rang, and it was Kevin Spacey. And, you know, I didn't believe him. I ended up hanging up on him. eventually I realized it was Kevin, and he said, I want to make a movie out of this. And the funny thing was we then took the project out to every studio in Hollywood, and everyone turned it down except for MGM, which owned all the casinos that we had been hitting. They wanted to make their money back, so it ended up being an MGM movie, Sony MGM. But
they got their money back that way.
Yeah, Kevin was great. Lawrence Fishburne was in it. Kate Bosworth. It was
that's
great.
Super. Now, the story about Facebook, the accidental billionaires, that must have been intriguing for you.
I mean, that was wild. You know, it ended up being a very, very good, very big movie. Really, it started with an email, a 2 in the morning email. A Harvard student emailed me because he had seen 21, he had read Breaking Down the House about the MIT kids, and he emailed me and said, you know, my best friend co-founded Facebook and no one's ever heard of him. And I ended up going out for a drink, and it was Eduardo from the movie. And Eduardo Saverin, you know, he'd been partners with Zuckerberg and been kind of kicked out of the company, and he was angry and he wanted to tell his story. So I wrote a book proposal.
Did he make any money on the eventual public sale of stock with Facebook or anything?
Well, they settled with him for $5 billion.
Oh, wow.
So he made a lot of money. He did very well. But really, because of the book, they were trying to stop the book with the settlement agreement. So they basically did a settlement with him. And the first thing it says in the settlement agreement is you may no longer speak to Ben Mezrich. Because they were trying to cut off.
Wow. I guess he had to honor that if he signed it, right?
He honored it. He disappeared. He sent a legal restraining order to me. He moved to Singapore. He broke up with the girl he was dating because she was my wife's best friend.
Oh, you're kidding.
Didn't have any contact with me.
Wow. Took it. He didn't even say, hey, sorry, I got to go?
Well, listen, for $5 billion, I understand.
Had they come up to you, Ben, and said, don't do the book, don't do the book, here's $5 billion, would you have taken it?
I would have taken a lot less. I mean, you know, that sort of thing doesn't really happen, but it is intriguing to think that they could have stopped the book a lot easier.
And these guys, if memory serves me, they just blew past MySpace. I mean, Facebook wasn't even around. MySpace was it, and they just came blowing in. What happened? How did it work?
Yeah, it was a matter of weeks, really. So Zuckerberg, you know, wrote the site in 2 weeks, basically. It spread first around Harvard. They did a very intelligent thing where they essentially made it you couldn't join it. Only people at first at Harvard could join. Then it went from Ivy League school to Ivy League school. Then it went to other colleges. Then it went to high schools. And basically the way they rolled it out, it made people want to be a part of something they couldn't be a part of. Eventually, when they opened it up, it was just so much cleaner than MySpace. You know, the way MySpace worked, where everyone could make their own pages, it was just a pain to use. It was a big mess.
Yeah.
Facebook was real easy, and it went by friend by friend by friend. It just grew organically.
Yeah.
It happened so fast, though. I mean, they went from thousands to millions to billions in a matter of months.
When did they start monetizing it?
Well, that's the thing. Mark never cared about money, and he still doesn't really care about money, even though he's one of the richest people in the world. It was never about money. In fact, Eduardo always wanted to try and sell ads and things like that, and Mark was always like, don't worry about it. We're not about money. It's not about money. They didn't really start monetizing it until it already had hundreds of millions of users. And now it makes tons of money, but it was never money. It was never part of the equation.
And I really still don't get how they make money, because I don't know anybody who's bought a product because they were on Facebook.
I mean, it's crazy, but they make a ton of money.
I guess it's dollars. Impressions.
It's all these ads. It's ads. It's ads. It's all ad-based as of now. And it's not a lot of money, but it's so many users that it doesn't take very much to reach a large number.
And they reach a lot of people. They really do. I mean, just brilliant.
Most of the world.
Are there other people out there working on things that are going to blow our minds?
I mean, you know, I get calls all the time from people who are working on something pretty spectacular. My next book is essentially about the world of genetics. I'm writing a book called Woolly, about the de-extinction of the woolly mammoth. This is a Harvard lab, it's a true story. A guy named George Church, who's one of the most brilliant men alive, his team is making a woolly mammoth. And they're going to build a herd of them and then repopulate the Siberian tundra with extinct woolly mammoths. And it's this explosion in genetics that I think is really the next big thing where people are going to make fortunes. The world is changing dramatically.
Robots, too, are going to be huge.
I mean, robots are big and scary, and there's lots of sort of both positive and negative stories about that. Things happen so fast in science. You know, it's one day it's Facebook, and the next day, you know, it's artificial intelligence or genetic, you know, engineering or whatever it is, and it's hard to keep up.
I mean, I won't be surprised to see some guy take a robot woman out to dinner.
It'll happen sooner than we think. I think it already happens in Japan to some degree.
Low check. You won't have to pay for the other half.
That's right.
She won't eat.
Right. It's perfect. Right.
That's going to happen, though. It's already happening, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff going on in robotics that is quite impressive. I mean, you see some of these advances that they're almost human-like, and that happens usually in Japan more than here. Here, it's more utilitarian. It's more about assembly lines and robots that work like that. And in Japan, it's more of this person-based
companions and pets.
Exactly. But it's interesting, yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Mike in West Palm Beach, Florida, to get us started. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. Michael, you with us? He's not there, I don't think. Nope. Let's go to Tom in Riverside, California, though. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, George.
Hey, we got you. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Man, I'd like to ask you about the this highway. Is crop circles involved in that quest?
Crop circles? Any crop circles involved in any of the stories you've covered?
I think that Chuck does go into, I don't go into it in the book. I think Chuck himself has gotten a little bit into the crop circle thing. I didn't get into crop circles at all. I don't know anything about it. You know, I tried to stay in the realm of what Chuck was looking at, you know, mostly UFO sightings and mostly cattle mutilations. I don't know a lot about the crop circle phenomenon. I do know, you know, there's definitely been talk about whether it's real or not, and I just didn't really get into it, so I don't know, but I do think there are some spots that are on the 37th parallel.
You know, Ben, even if one crop formation is legitimate in terms of ET constructed or something, I'll tell you my theory in a second, then there's something to this.
Right. And that's interesting, yeah.
I think the planet is alive. It's an organism, and it's the planet's way of communicating with us.
Well, I mean, that's cool.
It's strange. People see vortexes over these crop formations, you know, windy type things.
Right.
And then all of a sudden there's the formation. No people are seen out there. It's strange.
That's amazing. You know, I do get into the vortex of Sedona in the story. Chuck does go to Sedona and the idea of these vortexes, which are very intriguing. So maybe there is a relationship between those two things.
Mike is back from West Palm Beach, Florida. Mike, where'd you go?
Sorry, I pressed the wrong button on my cell phone, so I got cut off. I cut myself off.
All right.
Question I have for the guests is this. Are UFOs involved in air crashes and disappearances like that Malaysian thing? I got a feeling something's going on with the government with this. This is my theory. My theory is that most of these UFOs are government military vehicles or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They fly around disregarding airspace, where they go, they land, whatever it is. And that's why I think they threaten the pilots, because there's liabilities here. If these things are smashing into planes and causing crashes, the government's liable on this. So the best way to get around it is to threaten the pilots and say, shut your mouth, we hear about these things, all right? They don't exist. That's my theory, but what if the guests think?
All right, go ahead, Ben. What do you think of that possibility?
I mean, I think it's very interesting and great, and I do think a lot of these things are secret military projects, and when it's discovered that people have seen it, the military uses the whole UFO thing to hide what they're doing. That certainly went on in the 50s and 60s, where they would even send an Air Force, you know, representative to UFO symposiums to enhance the belief in UFOs, because it was a good way of hiding what they were doing. So I do think, you know, there was recently a sighting over L.A., and it turned out to be a missile test that had gone awry. And so, yes, I do think that happens a lot, and I wouldn't be surprised if there have been numbers of crashes that were related to black ops projects or secret military developments. I mean, the development of the stealth bomber was something that took many years, involved flying a plane that other planes couldn't see, and I'm sure they tested it in regular airspace.
People saw them, and they looked like UFOs.
Exactly, and so I do think a large portion of these things, and that's what Bigelow himself finds in the book, one of these things, a large portion of them are test projects. But like you're saying with crop circles, it only takes one.
That's all it takes.
Tens of thousands of them. If one of them is real, that's all it really needs. Yeah.
What do you think of the incredible abduction cases from people who claim to be abducted?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real phenomenon. I did not get into it in this book because it's something that could be a whole book in itself and has been. It's something that's pretty spectacular. And what gets me and what's intriguing to me and is also related to this book is the idea that when people have these experiences, they're truly traumatized by them. It's not fake. You know, these people aren't making stories up. To them, at least, it's true. And so it gets you into sort of what is true and what isn't true. I think there is something to that. I don't know about the vast majority of them, but I do think that there's been enough of these abduction cases that there's something going on, but I really don't know enough about it to get into it.
Joe is in Virginia, first-time caller. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, gentlemen. How y'all doing tonight?
Good, Joe. Thank you.
Good. Just a general question. I've had an experience myself, but I didn't know if either one of you gentlemen had heard of a UFO that would be like bright as the brightest thing you can think of, but octagonal shape, like a stop sign, but with more size. And in the middle, it would pulsate gray. and you would see gray in the center, gray in a line, and then it'd get bigger gray in a line. It would pulsate throughout the actual thing. But have you ever heard of anything like that?
I have not heard of that, Joe. What I have heard in the case of Fatima in Portugal, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of witnesses saw what they thought was the sun coming down. Now, we know that's not possible. It would have burned everybody up if that had happened. I think what they saw was a UFO that was in that vicinity. Maybe they had landed. Maybe the occupants they thought was the Blessed Virgin Mary. Who knows? But I think they saw a silvery disc come down, and they confused that for the sun. That's about all I know on something like that, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a specific story relating to that. I mean, the most common UFOs sighted were either triangular, cigar-shaped, or saucer-shaped. Certainly a lot of them have pulsated. The whole idea of an incredibly bright lights is a part of it. I think in Rendlesham in the UK, there was bright lights and a cone of light and beams of light. But that specific description I haven't gotten to.
So back to the story that you wrote about Las Vegas, the inside story of the six MIT students who took Vegas for millions of dollars. Where are these people now?
Yeah, so there, you know, what's great about that story is these were all really smart kids who could do just about anything. The main character actually works at Twitter now. His real name was Jeff Ma, and you know, he had his own company for a while, which he sold to Twitter, and then he became a part of that company. One of the other kids is at a hedge fund, you know, uses his math to make even more money, a bigger form of gambling, I guess. And
they got their degrees, I guess, right?
The woman in the movie who Kate Bosworth plays is actually a high-powered lawyer in Boston. She works at Ropes and Gray and is a partner. And so all of them have kind of moved on to really, really great jobs. None of them play blackjack anymore for the most part because they can't. They'll get kicked out pretty quickly.
They get recognized, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you walk into Vegas with them, and immediately security comes over and says, you're not allowed to play here.
Wow. The cameras get them that quickly?
Oh, very fast. It's a facial recognition software for the most part. If not, then there's always a pit boss or someone like that who recognizes them. But I get kicked out. I mean, I've been kicked out of a couple places just for associating with these guys. They're just really true.
Have you learned the system?
Yes, I mean, I know how to card count. I don't practice it, and my math.
Well, what's the basis for it? What's the idea?
Really, all you do is you keep track of the high cards. So when you're playing blackjack,
like the tens and the nines,
the tens, jacks, kings, queens, and aces.
Okay.
And once you know that more high cards are still in the deck, so you know that a lot of low cards have come out, and you really need to know the exact number, and that's what these guys are really good at. But when you know that there are more high cards still in the deck, you have an advantage because the dealer's going to bust more often and you're going to hit.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. We're going to come back and take final calls in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Our final segment with Ben Mezrich as we talk about all his books, including The 37th Parallel, and we'll take your final calls as well. Ben, your thoughts on Roswell. Do you think something strange happened there?
I mean, I'm a believer at this point that something did crash there that to this day hasn't been identified. I think the wreckage is at Area 51, and I think there was a very well-coordinated cover-up at the time, a photograph that was faked showing a weather balloon, and I think that it's pretty clear that whatever it was that landed, the Air Force to this day doesn't know what it is. So that, to me, leads me to believe that of all the things that I've looked at, I think Roswell is still, to me, the most likely debris that we have of something from out there.
Early on in the program, you were talking about some debris. Do you want to be a little more specific on that?
Sure. I mean, well, what happened at Roswell is, you know, there was a crash during an electrical storm. The rancher found metallic pieces that supposedly had hieroglyphics of some sort on them. They were, you couldn't burn it. It was a sort of a flexible material that didn't burn, essentially. At the time, that debris was carted off by the Air Force. They went through the field, you know, inch by inch, and took all of that debris off that field. and placed it essentially on an airplane, the flight was then stopped where they faked that photograph, and then the airplane continued on to Area 51. Now, Chuck Zukowski, in my book, 37th Parallel, Chuck goes on an archaeological dig at Roswell, ends up digging at the essentially the right level to reach that time period, and found a very small triangular piece of metal that he believed was related to that debris field, essentially. His piece of metal was then sent to Bigelow's people. Bigelow's scientists looked at it, you know, did analysis on it, and came to the conclusion that it was made of numerous materials that are found both here and in space, but it didn't match anything they had in their database, which isn't to say it was necessarily extraterrestrial, but it was simply to say that it wasn't, you know, a piece of duct tape or something like that. You know, it was intriguing, and it relates back to the Roswell story of 1947.
And back to the 21 story in that movie, if you're talking about a two deck, right? There's what?
Well, I mean, the kids in the blackjack team played a six deck shoe, so they would actually play on a six deck shoe because even though, you know, it was slightly lower odds, you had more time to play with it. So if the deck got good, say a quarter of the way into the deck, you might have 10 or 15 hands with a good deck, where you're earning a percentage of money each time.
Right.
So they played six-deck shoes. As long as it's not an automatic shuffler, you can card count it.
The cutting of the deck, you know, where you put the card in the middle,
right.
What do they do that for?
Yeah, so cutting is a really interesting advanced technique, it's called, where essentially, you know, after the blackjack dealer shuffles up, they roll the deck into a line, essentially, and they offer the cut card to one of the players. If you're sitting in the seat to the dealer's left, you can actually see the bottom card on that deck. When you're handed the cut card, you cut to exactly 100 cards from the bottom of the deck. And I know that sounds really hard, but if you practiced it 4 hours a day for a month, you'd be able to do it. The dealer then moves the front of the deck to the back, and now you know that the 101st card is that card that you saw. If that card happens to be an ace, which happens a couple times an hour, you now know where an ace is. So all you do is you play down the deck. You and your team takes over the table, and you count down 100 cards until you have the ace lined up, and then you bet $10,000.
God.
You know, when you get an ace, you're going to win most of the time, 70% of the time. And so that's essentially how cutting works. It's pretty wild to watch. It looks like a magic trick.
And do you go by the statistics? This fascinates me, the mathematics of all this.
Yeah, it's all about statistics. So the interesting thing about the MIT Blackjack team is they were not gambling. It was entirely math.
It was scientific for them.
They knew exactly what their expected return was. They'd even make these computer graphs of what they were supposed to earn every
night. And what did they do, memorize all this when they went in there?
They practiced and practiced. You had to practice 6 months to join.
You couldn't pull out a chart and look at it, obviously.
No, you're not allowed to do that. I mean, well, actually, you are allowed to have playing charts with you.
Cheat sheets, we call them, right?
Yeah, but if you had a big card counting chart with you, I think it would raise them.
Here's a graph, and here's this. And
right.
I mean, they
right.
don't even allow you to look at your cell phone at a table anymore.
No, you don't use your cell phone. You don't use any devices. Smart watches or anything like that. Anything like that can be considered cheating. But using your brain is not cheating. They'd rather you didn't do that either. But,
is that why they deal so fast? So you can't keep up with it?
Basically, most of it is really just to get as many hands as possible. The casino has such an edge over the average player that their whole goal is just to play.
Hey, Vegas was not built by winners.
No, it's all about everyone who walks in there has an expected loss. Back when I wrote the book, the expected loss of an average traveler to Vegas was $300 a night. So basically that's what they could expect from every person who walked into a casino.
Wow.
And, you know, it's all math from their side and from
yep.
the kids' side.
To the phones we go. Cody is in Corona, California. Cody, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to bring up a guy named Phil Schneider. Supposedly he worked, his dad worked His dad was actually the person that took care of the alien that crash landed in Roswell.
And Phil Schneider is dead now, sadly. Wrote some great stories.
So you have heard of him?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have too, Ben.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the characters in the book is the mortician who gave the coffins over to them.
At Roswell.
Right. So that's part of the story.
His last name, I think, was Dennis.
Right. And Chuck becomes good friends with him.
Is he still alive, the old guy?
He passed away as well.
He just died. Or they're all dying now.
Yep. People who were all there, all the first-person accounts are all going away. Chuck got to be friends with him, and he's the one who actually gave Chuck the actual coordinates of one of the crash sites that wasn't as well known. That story's in there as well. It's fascinating, the idea of whether there were bodies or not, why they wanted all these child-sized coffins.
And originally, the Army Air Force announced that they had a crashed saucer.
Right.
That's what they said.
It's unbelievable to me, and it's hard to discount that. And when people say, okay, weather balloon, well, these were professional. I mean, it was a radar operator. These were people who would know even what an experimental weather balloon looked like.
Exactly.
So, the fact that they announced they had a flying saucer and then rescinded their own announcement, it's very suspicious.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get past.
It really is. And then, the pilot told his son, Marcel, that he flew these strange parts out. The whole thing is just suspicious. It really is. I would have loved to have been a witness to that.
Exactly. And, eventually, I believe that debris is still at Area 51. I think that debris is in a warehouse. I do think eventually it will come out. And who knows, within the next few years.
First-time caller, Carl, in San Angelo, Texas. Carl, hi.
Yes, it's in San Angelo, Texas. I moved down here. But anyways, I'm from Hazleton, Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, my dad was were farmers out there and stuff, and I was about 8, 7, 6 around that age. They had something, they found like 20 or 30 head of cattle that were skinned completely.
Oh, jeez.
Wow. And there was no tracks around them. There was nothing. I was just a little kid from listening to the older people talk about it. But they had no blood in them. But they were full. They looked swollen, if I remember right. And there's lots of desert out there and stuff. But there was a big deal that they couldn't figure out how they skinned them and no cuts or nothing. And it was like remember right, Dad said it was like a laser or something. And I'm just listening. I was a little kid listening to all this. But that was interesting.
Any blood at the scene, Carl?
No, there was no blood, no
nothing.
Cuts, no nothing.
Oh.
And they blamed it on, they had a lot of Satan things, Satanist worshippers go around.
Sure, they said it was a cult.
Going around there. Yeah, and they were trying to blame it on that. But what Dad said, they were talking about, he says, but there was no blood. And he says there was no puncture wounds, there was no nothing. They didn't even know how they died.
That's unusual, too. I had a case, Carl and Ben, a friend of mine, was a reporter for a local St. Louis television station, and he was assigned to go out to a place, I think it was Elmore, Missouri, and he covered a story of there was a dead cow in the middle of a ring, and the other cows were walking around it in a circle. But he said, that's not the unusual thing. He said, the unusual thing is on the side of a tree, there were a million dead flies cooked into the tree, just burned right in. Now, how does that happen?
Very creepy. It's amazing. And what's amazing is the similarity of all these cases, 10,000 cases spanning 50 years. And you have these same descriptions, the skinning, the bloodlessness, the I mean, it's unbelievable. And the idea, the go-to answer of law enforcement is always, Satanists. And it's really not a good answer. The idea that there's this massive conspiracy of Satanists spanning 70 years in multiple states just isn't believable. Without evidence, you would have somebody arrested at this point. It's really intriguing.
We have Gregory in Calgary, Canada. Hey, Greg, go ahead.
Well, yeah, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
All right. So we were talking about the UFO superhighway, right?
Right. Yep.
So I was in Thailand, and this guy was running around the beach, and he said, "Gotta see, gotta see, gotta see." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he's like, "Come sit here. There'll be two giant amber orbs will appear in the sky on the right, and then one will appear on the left, and then they'll meet in the middle and disappear." And I said, "Yeah, I doubt that's even going to happen." And I sat on the beach, and sure enough, it started happening, and I started to, you know, freak out. I've never seen anything like that. And then they came and met in the middle and then disappeared. And then it kept on moving down, and there was a ridge of trees and forest there, and they went down behind. So it was like it was moving with the rotation of the earth. It was like they're meeting in a certain spot. It was amazing.
Wow. That's cool. I mean, yeah, you know, it's the idea that there's a specific, you know, place where you can predict where something's going to happen, or you've seen it before in the same place is essentially what Chuck is trying to get at. The idea that there might be this highway, this whatever, for whatever reason, this place, you'll see it over and over again.
Chuck's still investigating on an active basis, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, this is what he does. You know, every night he's emailing me with another mutilation or another sighting. And his goal, essentially, with this book coming out and the publicity around it, is that he'll be able to get to these things quicker, yeah, because people will know him as the guy.
Is he listening to you tonight?
I have no idea. I hope so. I don't know. I know he's coming to Boston to you know, go to my book party and everything. The book literally just came out today, so we'll see how this affects him and his world.
Veronica in Irvine, California now. Hi, Veronica. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, George.
Hi.
This is my first time calling.
Well, thank you. Glad you got in.
Okay. I'm calling because it's about the crop circles.
All right.
We're talking about, and how they do the patterns and how no one's ever seen it happen.
Yes.
And the reason why is because the aliens have developed a way of being completely, you don't see them. They're there, but you don't see them because even their ships and themselves, they're able to just be just.
They cloak them, don't they?
They've disappeared. They're doing it, and you don't see it.
Are they coming from other dimensions?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, a lot of people believe that. Jacques Vallée believes that. That's just another one of those theories, Ben, that they're coming from other dimensions.
Right. I mean, that's the, you know, potential around the whole vortex phenomenon, the skinwalker phenomenon. One of the theories, you know, of Bigelow's people was that it's interdimensional. Yeah, it's one of the possibilities.
Ben, give out your website, if you would, and where people could still get your books.
Sure. So benmesrick.com, just my name. The 37th Parallel should be in every airport and every bookstore today, tomorrow, and it's on Amazon and anywhere you want to buy it. I'm on Twitter at Ben Mesrick and Facebook at Ben Mesrick, so I hope to hear from people.
When you go to the movies and watch your book turned into a movie, what's it feel like for you?
I mean, the first time I watched 21, I remember I was sitting next to Lawrence Fishburne in a studio on the Sony lot, and it was just one of those weird, ridiculous experiences in your life. It's awesome. You know, you live with the story for so long when you're writing it. Then when you see it on the big screen, it's hard to describe. It's an amazing experience.
With the two movies, you're happy with the way they presented the book?
Well, I mean, The Social Network was just an amazing movie. It had David Fincher and Aaron Sorkin. And really, it was just one of the best movies I'd seen in a long time. And really well done. And 21 was just so much fun. You know, it was aimed at
Spacey made it fun too.
Yeah, and it was aimed at the kid who just turned 21, was on his way to Vegas for the first time, and I think it really captured that spirit. So both were great. I've been very lucky.
All right, my friend. Thank you, Ben, for being on the program. We always look forward to having you on. So can't wait for your next story, your next book. For Nathan Staton, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.